Real Life, the program that talks about the life of real estate in the Hamptons and the North Fork. The people, the places, and the things that are the pulse and heartbeat of life on the East End. And now, Associate Broker of Sotheby's International Realty, your host, John Christopher.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and I have with me today the delightful Andrew Lieb of Lieb at Law. Hey, Andrew, how are you?
Well, I'm doing deceptively well today, John. How are you doing?
That leads me right into talking about deceptive and misleading advertising. But before we go there, you know, you have a real estate school, so I just want to I had taken this course, and I found it very fascinating, and I think it's the kind of thing for continuing education that's great for real estate agents. And what is the school called, and can you give us a little background on it?
Sure, I can. It's called Lieb School, like Long Island Education Board School.com. And at Lieb School, we have online and in-person education. Our online and in-person education reaches about 8,500 students in New York State. We do tons and tons and tons and tons of continuing ed. In fact, tomorrow night we're teaching the condo course. We're going to be launching that. We have some other cool courses coming up, like selling a business. But what we really do, John, is we've realized that real estate brokerage is a profession. And we've realized that there's so many people out there that don't take it seriously. And we've determined that if we give the tools to the real professionals out there, they'll stand out from all the rest. So an individual like yourself says to yourself, I want to learn how to be doing everything on the up and up. And you really differentiate yourself on the market, and that's why we've become friends over these years.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very kind of you to say. Andrew, so let's talk about some of the things about deceptive and misleading advertising. Why do they have...
How come you keep coming to me with deceptive? Do you just think everything about me is deceptive? Thanks,
well,
John.
That was the course that I learned. Actually, I came to your class, and it was fascinating, actually, because I enjoyed it because it was very... You're entertaining plus also educational, so the combination is a great combo. But anyway, let me go to the first question. We're talking about ad regulations that are imposed by what? The state, the federal government? But what about we have freedom of speech? Why do we have to be regulated if we can be free to say what we have to say according to the First Amendment?
What a great question. And shouldn't we be able to say whatever we want to say?
Yeah.
Like, John, I should be able to say to all my clients, you give me $1 million and you win every case. I should be able to say to all my clients, you come see me and you get to buy a house for $10. Because at the end of the day, your real question is, you're saying, why is there restrictions on speech if there's free speech? But guess what? Commercial speech is different than normal speech. You see, when you're trying to sell something, it's not free speech. It's commercial. It's a special subset of speech where aren't we concerned about the public at large understanding it is what they're getting, what they're buying? And we have to regulate people because, after all, can you just do brokerage and wake up one day? Or are you licensed to do brokerage by the state? So to answer all your questions in one, is that the state regulates. Because the federal government said that they could regulate, and the branch of the federal government that said they could regulate is the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said is that you can regulate misleading and dishonest speech in the commercial sector.
Hmm. So that's why we have these certain guidelines that we have to follow then, correct?
Well, imagine going to the supermarket, right? And instead of it saying broccoli, it says superhuman food that makes you run really, really fast. Imagine going, no, seriously, like imagine you drive, instead of a sign that would say something auto group, it would say amazing flying machines. Right. People would just make up, so we have to protect consumers. And I think what you found so fascinating, at least what I was trying to project was so fascinating, is the degree that people are trying to deceive. When we were teaching the class and you were in that classroom, how many people raised their hand and said, could I get away with this? Could
right.
I get away with this?
Right.
Could I get away with this? Like, why? Why can't people just sell by saying it is what it is? And
right.
That's what the regulations are about. The regulations say, you know what? Let's not call spit rain when it's spit.
Right. Yeah, it makes sense. What about photography? You know, a lot of times you'll see... in ads, you know, and I've had this with showing homes that the house doesn't necessarily look like what it is in reality. Is there any regulation to that, or is it just falls under puffery?
I love the way how kind you put it. The house doesn't look the way it is. Like, the house you go to, you look at the picture, it's three stories with a balcony overlooking the water. You go there, it's a half of a story, and it's got a little swamp in the backyard.
Right.
Like, that's how the degree of change, it's not like a subtle change. So the answer to your question is, isn't it deceptive and misleading? And so you asked at the course, and well, I'll repeat right now so everyone knows, there's two different categories of ways that speech is regulated when it comes to real estate brokerage and sales. One is there's a statute that just uses the word deceptive and misleading, and that's a catch-all. But then we have a regulation at 19 New York Code of Rules and Regulations, Part 175.25, which illustrates specific things that are wrong or right. When it comes to pictures and manipulating pictures, that's just a general thing. It's misleading unless, because what you're getting at is these photoshopped. Aren't we hiring an art director to change it and look better? Isn't that why they're hiring a broker? And there's nothing wrong with that, John. What's wrong with it is when you don't put a disclaimer that says these images have been manipulated and do not accurately represent the property as it currently exists. Now, if they were to say that on it, there's nothing wrong because then you know what you're looking at. But if you were to go there and you expect the Taj Mahal and instead you get Rudolph the Dog's Hall, there's a big problem.
It's happened. So, but you never,
probably
I've never
every
seen
day in your life.
Right. I have yet to see that. I've seen where people will put in a pool and most people, and it's small lettering, and I'll have a client call me and say, oh, let's go take a look at that house. It's got a great looking pool. And if you don't read the fine print, you can barely see it sometimes. It says, you know, pool is added.
I want to address that, what you just said.
Go ahead.
Because I was teaching a compliance class yesterday, and one of the agents said to me in the class, it was for brokers, I was at a company, I do compliance for companies, one of the agents raised their hand and she says to me, well, if my client finds a property and they could go on their own, why would they want me?
Interesting.
And I said to them back, is your job to be a matchmaker or a evaluator? Because the internet could help you find property. I'll bet you, John, your clients can find the house before you can find the house.
Absolutely.
That's really not what you're doing, right? Zillow's got it. You got it on Stratus. You got it on Realtor.com. You could find, like, it's on Facebook. People are advertising every day. So what is it that a buyer's agent's really doing? Knowing to look for the fine print.
Right.
Isn't that what you're really doing? Isn't the reason they're coming to John Christopher, as opposed to going on their own and looking at the property, John Christopher says to them, listen, before we go there, let me do my due diligence. In English, that means I'm going to actually research what we're buying. Maybe you would go over, say we're in Sag Harbor, you go over to Village, you go to the Village and you say, clerk, could I have the CO for this property? When you get the CO, you see if they have actually a legal pool. See, you and I are talking about manipulating pictures, but advertising goes even further. What happens if there really is a pool? What happens if it's really not manipulated? And what happens if it's an accurate picture, but it's illegal?
Oh.
Meaning they never got permits from the town. Isn't right. that still deceptive advertising?
Yep. I would think so.
So I'm going to tell you my favorite one, and this is in the industry, as you and I are talking about what a broker knows. John, when you see the word bonus room, that's what something they write,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yep.
Yeah, they write bonus room. What does that mean to a broker when they write bonus room? See, I'm flipping this.
It's supposed to be a bedroom, but you can't say a bedroom because the town says you have three bedrooms, and really you're trying to sell four bedrooms, but you can't say there are four bedrooms because it's not legal, correct?
So isn't that fabulous, what John just said? What John just told you is that they're trying to say by the word bonus room that it's a detriment room. Does everyone hear that? I want everyone to hear that. John said that there's only three legal bedrooms, and they would call it four bedrooms if it was legal, but they're calling it three bedrooms in a bonus room because it's illegal. So what happens when you get that illegal room? Let's say you're the buyer, and you go buy that, and you get that illegal room. Well, nothing happens, right, John? Nothing happens until your neighbor complains to the town and code enforcement comes. And when code enforcement comes, and they say, by the way, here's a ticket. And by the way, we're going to continually every week give you a ticket, and you're going to continually have to pay this until you remediate the issue, meaning rip out the illegal structure, get the appropriate permits, get the COs. That's what's going to happen. So you and I just had a very fascinating conversation. We started off with it doesn't exist, and the Photoshop manipulated it to be there. But what happens when it actually exists, but legally it shouldn't be there?
Right.
My compliance course yesterday said, what does a buyer's agent do? That's what a buyer's agent does.
Exactly. Well, you know, Andrew, as I said earlier, it's always delightful having you on the program. You're very educational. If somebody needed to get some legal advice or at least some of your legal acumen, how could they do that?
The easiest way is just give me a buzz on the telephone, 646-216-8009. 646-216-8009. We have a team of attorneys that could help anyone.
And they're a fantastic team. Thank you, Andrew, so much for coming on the program. This is John Christopher, and we'll be right back with our next guest, the director of the Pollock Krasner House in East Hampton, Helen Harrison.
Support for 88.3 comes from Sotheby's International Realty, local experts worldwide. With over 100 international offices, Sotheby's has four Hamptons locations in Southampton, Bridgehampton, East Hampton, and Sag Harbor. Learn more at john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com.
Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher, and today I have with me the director of the Pollock Krasner House, Helen Harrison. Hi, Helen, how are you tonight?
Hi, John, I'm well. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Before we talk about Jackson Pollock and your directorship of the Pollock Krasner House, let's talk about you. You must have had a very interesting background, so tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Queens, in Richmond Hill. And I went to Adelphi University to study art. I started out my checkered career as a sculptor.
Mm.
And went to the Brooklyn Museum Art School, learned more sculpture there, went to the Hornsey College of Art in London, did that as well, and practiced for a number of years as a sculptor when I was living in England.
So that's interesting. So now, if you were into sculpting, I'm just thinking what you were saying is like, how did you get into the oils as compared to getting into the metals?
Oh, I never was a painter. Everything I touched turned to mud, so I figured sculpture would be the answer to that.
Right.
But after a few years, I became interested in the government art programs that had operated in this country during the 1930s when artists were actually on the federal payroll. And I thought I'd like to learn more about that in a serious way. So I went back to graduate school and studied art history, focusing on the New Deal art projects of the 1930s.
Interesting. So along the way, did you have a mentor that like was guiding you or giving you advice or anything?
Oh, I certainly did. When I was an undergraduate at Adelphi, my sculpture teacher said, "Are you serious?" And I said, yes. And he said, well, you better marry rich, which, of course, I did not take that advice, but it was good advice.
Don't they say it's just as easy to fall in love with a rich person as it is a poor person?
Well, I found it very easy to fall in love with my artist husband. And we're about to celebrate our 52nd wedding anniversary.
No, that's so wonderful. Okay, let me digress for 1 second. What is the secret to the longevity of the marriage?
Well, probably having no children was maybe a bit helpful, because we didn't have to fight over that. But having something in common, I think, for us, it certainly worked. The fact that we were both artists and both had that as a background was, I think, very helpful.
No.
But we had compatible personalities,
well,
I guess.
I wish you all the best and have another 52 more years, okay?
No, thank you very much.
So let's go back to your mentor, okay? Yeah, you were talking about him.
Yes, in graduate school, I had a mentor, Francis O'Connor, who was a wonderful scholar and really a New Deal specialist who also happens to be a specialist in Jackson Pollock. It was an interesting combination because when I came to the Pollock Krasner House, it seemed almost like fate. But then I had another teacher who was also very influential, an art historian named Carol Ann Marling, and she really got me interested in doing practical work, exhibition organizing, and rather than going in an academic direction to become a professor, I decided that I would rather do a hands-on kind of approach and become a curator.
Wow. Speaking of curators, you were a curator at the Parish Art Museum. What was that like? And you know, how does one decide to what's going to be shown? I mean, do you come up with themes, or how does that work?
Well, of course, the parish, and when I worked there in the 1970s, it was on Job's Lane in the old building. But it has a collection. And museums with collections are really paramount. The paramount interest is to use the collection in a creative way. So you're actually working with a given, and you try to build exhibitions around the strengths of your collection.
Oh, that's interesting. You mentioned in your bio Aunt Dolly. How was she influential in your career?
Well, my mother was the youngest of 13 children.
13.
And one of her older sisters was Dorothy. And she was, if you've ever met a self-motivated person, that was Dolly. She was a sailor. She built her own house. I mean, this woman was just amazing. And she was a real role model for me as someone who, when you set your mind to do something, you just do it. And if there's an obstacle in your way, you clear it away. That was really a formative experience for me growing up around her. She was also a bank officer. She was the second female to be named an officer of a bank in New York City back in the 1930s.
Wow.
And she was just a remarkable person.
She sounds that way. Jeez. I mean, you know, that at that time it was like the woman was supposed to be in the kitchen and barefoot, right?
Exactly.
Well, that's fortunately that has changed, hasn't it?
Well, it's interesting you say that, though, because women, during the New Deal, when the art projects were in force, women and men were given equal pay for equal work. It was a government program, and if you were qualified for it, you just got what you were qualified to get paid. So there was no discrimination. And a lot of the artists who worked on that program had a very rude awakening when the art market kicked in after the war. And that was one of the things that interested me, to learn how a very different system of rewarding creativity had functioned during that period.
Huh. Now, since you're running the Pollock Museum there, let's talk about Jackson. He was known to have a drinking problem, but his most prolific period was when he was sober. Most people think that dripping paint on a canvas, anyone could do that. But so what makes Pollock so special?
Well, it's quite true that anyone could drip paint on canvas, just like anybody can bang on a piano, but how good is it? You know, it's all a matter of technique and a matter of the mastering the fundamentals, the basics of your medium or your material. And if you give a certain material to anyone, they can do something with it, but is it going to be any good? That's the question.
Right. That's fascinating. Now, besides being a curator and a director, you're also an author of mystery novels. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
That's my latest foray. I decided that I do read mystery novels, and I decided that maybe I could write one, and I did, and it was published, and now I have a book contract for three of them with a publisher out in the Midwest.
That's fantastic. I'm sorry to interrupt. I find it great.
Well, I decided to write about things that interested me, and so I set them in the art world, which I've inhabited my entire life, so of course it was familiar territory for me. But the first one is set in the 1940s, just when I was being born. The second one in the 1950s, and the third one in the 1960s. Now I'm working on a fourth one set in the 1970s.
Wow, good for you. Now, you know, it sounds like you're pretty busy and you still have time to write. That's pretty amazing.
Well, I try to keep out of trouble, and right. Keeping busy is the best way.
Exactly. So when is the Pollock Krasner House open, and exactly where is it?
Well, we're up in Springs at 830 Springs Fireplace Road. It's open Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. We have guided tours by appointment on Thursday and Friday. Then on Saturday, you can come without an appointment and take a self-guided tour, but you do need to park off-site because we have very limited parking here. Now, but if you were to go to our website and click on Visiting Us, you would get all the information.
That is great. And how can someone get in touch with you?
Well, I am here at the Pollock House most days. You can always call. The number here is 631-324-4929, or you can email me at helen.harrison@stonybrook.edu. The property actually belongs to Stony Brook University's private foundation.
Wow, that is interesting. Thank you so much, Helen Harrison, director of the Pollock Krasner House. This is John Christopher for Real Life, and we'll be right back with our next guest, Diane Saatchi of Team Saatchi. Welcome back to Real Life, and this is your host, John Christopher. And today I have with me Diane Saatchi of Team Saatchi. Hi, Diane. How are you?
Hi, very well. How are you, John?
I'm wonderful, especially now that you're here.
Aww.
One of the things recently, I sold a client's house, and as we progressed through the closing process, even though the wife had sold a number of her homes before, the wife would ask me, "So, what is next?" And I recently read your blog. You have a blog that I find very fascinating. So I thought, let's talk about what to expect when selling your house. So the first thing you mentioned is the team. So tell us about the team.
Okay, not to be confused with Team Saatchi.
That's a good point. Yeah. Right, I hadn't thought about that.
Every homeowner, when they think of selling their house, has a lot of work to do. And there are a lot of people involved in the work. So I tell them that they need to organize a team of folks that are going to help them through the process. Real estate broker usually is the lead person in that effort, but there's, sometimes I use this analogy. If you're going to sell your house, sell your car, you're going to have it detailed. You're going to get rid of all the dings, and you're going to take it to a mechanic. So everything's in working order. So
that's
you have
analogy.
The cleaning people, the body shop folks, and the mechanics. That's the team when you're selling your house. Selling your car, because you want it to look its best. And you need to organize a number of people around a house. And it's a bit more complicated because you've owned it for a very long time and there are many more moving or not moving parts. The most important thing you need to do is to, one, get your surveyor and make sure that the property that you're selling is actually shown on the survey and there are no funny surprises there. And we could spend this whole interview talking about the funny surprises we'll find in an interview on a survey. You'll also want to...
But many times they... I don't mean to interrupt you, and you'll continue your thought, is that you go to the seller and you say, how about updating the survey? They say to me, if I do that, why doesn't the buyer?
Really good question. A new survey might cost $2,500. Usually takes between, depending upon the time of the year, a month to 2 months to get a survey. If we wait to get a buyer and the sale is held up by 2 months, that's two mortgage payments, two months of taxes, 2 months before you can move on to something else. And if you look at the money that you're saving, it turns out you're not saving money. You're just delaying things. So best to have your product ready to move and spend the money now rather than later. And I know a lot of people have trouble with that. And I have a great suggestion that very few people listen to, but they're really happy when they do, is one of the things you need to do is clean up your house. And the best way to clean it up and clean it out is to have a tag sale. And the money you make from the tag sale, you can use to pay for the survey, for trimming back your hedges, for taking care of the lawn, maybe even painting it. It's somewhat counterintuitive because people are not ready to pack, but it looks so much better to clean out your attic, your basement, and all your closets before you list it for sale.
That's a great idea.
Thank you. Feel free to use it. And don't quote me. Please quote me. One of the other benefits of having a tag sale ahead of time is everybody in town comes over thinking the house is sold. And you can say, no, it's not sold. I'm getting ready to sell it. And they are for free. Dozens of people know you're selling your house. And that's a good thing when you want to sell your house.
Right. So. Exactly. Plus, the thing is, it's kind of interesting that we collect things that we think we're going to use later. And of course, never do.
We don't.
And why wait till most people wait till after the house is sold to go for the tag sale to get rid of the furniture or to get rid of stuff, or they'll say to the potential buyer, are you interested in this furniture? And then that always clouds the issue, I think.
That's our nightmare.
Right.
It's
ridiculous sometimes, that people start quibbling on the most minute things. But anyway, I think that's a wonderful thing. So let's continue.
So part of the team were all the people that are going to help you clean up your house. Sometimes I suggest that one engage their family members, and that is there are lots of children and relatives and heirs who might want things that are in your house. Bring them over and let them pick out what they want now and let them take it rather than wait. Because most of those things are very personal. They mean a lot to you, and they're not going to help the house show well. So get rid of stuff. Clean things out. You have your cleaners. You have the surveyor. I often suggest that people have a home inspection, the same kind of inspection that a buyer is going to do. But rather than have the surprises later, have the surprises now. And then you can see what's wrong and either fix it or adjust the price accordingly. Next thing you need to do when you get your survey in hand is to update your certificate of occupancy to make sure all the things that were done to your house and property in the years that you've owned it have been done correctly. I've been doing this for almost 29 years now, and I get on one hand.
You look like you're 29.
I am 29. I started really young. And we're on radio, so this is totally true. Totally true. Everybody thinks that when they added the basement, the bathroom in the basement, or added a room on, or put their swimming pool in, or constructed the deer fence, that their contractor did it with all the proper paperwork. And as I said, in almost 29 years of doing this, I can count on one hand the number of times that everybody actually did it correctly. So you get to the, end, you're what everyone thinks is a week or a month from closing, and you find out that you have violations and you have to either start from scratch or delay the closing or hold money in escrow. And all of those things are going to cost you money.
Or take the deck out.
Deck out that's 8 inches bigger than it should have been or whatever. It's, real estate hates surprises, and it's much better to do that at the get-go. So the local building inspector is somebody else that you're going to engage and have on your team. And having him or her on your team is really very helpful because they don't like surprises either. So if they can come and tell you what needs to be done without, kind of the threat of having to close in a few days, they're much more helpful because they can be. They have the time to be helpful.
A lot of times I know, because I've been in that situation, and it's a good way. What you're suggesting is excellent, because they also are doing a lot of inspections of houses, and all of a sudden they point out, just a simple thing like, say, smoke alarms. They should be one over here, one over there, and then they have to come back again.
Right.
So it makes total sense what you're saying. Just take care of it now. So when they do come for the final CO to give you an updated CO, it's all done.
It's the Girl Scouts had it right. Be prepared.
Right. Was it the Girl Scouts?
Well, you think it was the Boy Scouts.
Right? I don't know.
Yeah. It was one of those Scouts.
One of those Scouts.
A number of people are really very surprised because they think they call a broker. The broker takes pictures. Pictures go online and in magazines, and somebody comes and buys them their house. And, a couple of little things happen. They have a ton of money, and they're on to the next project. It doesn't work that way. It sounds wonderful, but it takes an awful lot of work to be a seller. And it's our job as real estate brokers to explain that to would-be sellers and engage them in that process, because it really takes a village to get it done.
Right. Well, Diane, you've been very informative, and I'm so happy you came on the program. How can someone get in touch with you?
I work at Saunders & Associates. My email address is dsaatchi@saunders.com. I have a website, which is my name, www.diannesaatchi.com, and you could also read all my blogs.
Fantastic.
This is John Christopher for Real Life on Peconic Public Broadcasting, 88.3, right here in Southampton, New York. By the way, if you're interested in hearing this program again or previous ones, you can go to peconicpublicbroadcasting.org and subscribe to the podcast. Until next time, looking forward to seeing you soon, and have a safe journey.
You have been listening to Real Life, the program that talks to the people, places, and things that are the pulse and heartbeat of real estate on the East End. Your host has been John Christopher, broker associate with Sotheby's International Realty. Your producer and engineer is Kyle Lynch. Theme music by John Christopher. Questions and comments can be emailed to john.christopher@sotheby'shomes.com. Real Life is also brought to you in part by LEAP Compliance, HR's one-stop solution for sexual harassment prevention training and policies. All employers in the New York State are now required to train all employees annually, no matter the size of the company. For more information, discriminationpreventiontraining.com or 646-216-8038.